You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Good morning from Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining today's online discussion about the political and social outlook for Vietnam in 2025. Here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, we've launched a Vietnam program for a few years now, since 2021, with a focus on U.S.-Vietnam relations and addressing both physical and political legacies of the war. This program was started on a request from Congress, particularly former Senator Patrick Leahy, as a way to promote people-to-people and government-to-government dialogue between our countries. It contributes to USIP's mission as a national nonpartisan public institution, contributing to resolving violent conflicts around the world. And you can follow more information about USIP and our Vietnam program on our website. This coming year promises to be significant for Vietnam in several respects. The country will be marking a series of anniversaries, so 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War on April 30th, 1975, 30 years of normal diplomatic relations with the U.S., announced on July 11th, 1995, and 80 years since the 1945 revolution on September 2nd. At the same time, Vietnam's ruling Communist Party is preparing for the Party Congress, which occurs every 5 years. The next one, scheduled in January 26th, will be the 14th Party Congress. General Secretary Tô Lâm took office in August last year, following the passing of Nguyễn Phú Trọng and the resignation or dismissals of a majority of the previous generation of leaders. Change is clearly in the air. And the last few months have been occupied with an ambitious government restructuring plan. To discuss these and other potential top stories in Vietnam in 2025, I'm joined by four Vietnamese and American colleagues who are experts that we've invited to share their perspectives about domestic politics, foreign relations, media, environment, and civil society, among other topics. And I've proposed some general questions for reflection, while leaving the details up to each presenter, who are all sharing their independent views, not on behalf of the U.S. or Vietnamese government or any other organization. This discussion will run with each presenter having about 8 minutes to share their reflections, followed by questions and answers with the audience. And if you'd like to raise a question, please go to the USIP event page. And there's a prompt there where you can enter a written question. That's usip.org/events/outlook-vietnam-2025. Our first speaker is Nguyễn Hồng Hải, who is a Fulbright scholar at American University here in Washington, visiting from Vinh University in Hanoi, where he teaches and researches on politics and international relations. He's previously worked in Vietnam and Australia as an academic and development practitioner, and he's written widely on Vietnam and the Indo-Pacific generally. So welcome, Dr. Hai, and look forward to your reflections. Please.
Well, thank you very much, USIP, for hosting this webinar, which I think take place at an interesting times. And right before the eve of the Vietnamese Lunar New Year's. So happy New Year to everyone. And thank you, Andrew, for the kind introduction. Well, as Andrew said, I'm expected to speak within 8 minutes about political developments in Vietnam in 2024, and also the political outlook in Vietnam in 2025. So I will provide the general overviews of the political life in Vietnam, and then I prefer leaving the time for Q&As from the audience. Now, in 2024, there were three, and among other things, major political developments that changed I would argue, the cause of Vietnam's political development, not only in the year, but also in 2025 and highly likely in the year to come. So these developments were, in my own words, characterized as never, in quotation mark, happened in the CPV history, the Communist Party of Vietnam. Now, the first happening is the CPV disciplined the state president Võ Văn Thưởng, the chairperson of the National Assembly Vương Đình Huệ, and the standing members of the Secretariat Trương Thị Mai. So for those who are not familiar with Vietnamese politics, the state president, the chairperson of the National Assembly, are the two and ranked second and fourth respectively in the top or most popular and most powerful four positions, normally DFF, the four pillars in the Communist Party rule regime. Wise standing members of the Secretariat ranks the fifth among the 18 members of the Politburo. So it is notable that Thưởng's resignation took place around 1 year after his predecessor, Nguyễn Xuân Phúc, did the same thing. In other words, within 1 year, two state presidents, one chairperson of the National Assembly, and one standing member of the Secretariat were disciplined and relief from the position. And more broadly, if we look at the whole, the last 4 years or 3 years since 2021, there have been several members of the Politburo, four or five members of the Politburo, and dozens of members of the Central Committees were disciplined and had to resign. And the allegations on these people, the president, the chairperson of the National Assembly, are violation of the party rules, including prohibitions that party members are strictly required to follow. Now, the rumors on social media said the state president, the National Assembly chairperson, and other members of the Politburo and also Central Committees were linked with corruption, etc. Now, in Vietnam's politics and polity, given the fact that the party and the government manages and controls all the media, so the rumors are the rumors, and we just know what happened until it happened. So the discipline and resignation of three high-ranking officers took place within 3 months, which had not been seen before, Xin Đổi Mới, or even in the histories of the Communist Party of Vietnam. And it happened consecutively within a very short time that looked like a political earthquake, causing somehow psychological shocks in society. The second development in the past is the passing of the incumbent CPV, General Secretary Nguyễn Phú Trọng. Now, General Secretary Trọng was perhaps the most popular leader in Vietnam Xin Đổi Mới because of his ethical lifestyle and leading a staunch anti-corruption campaign DFF as Đốt Lò or Fierce Furnace. The campaign was launched from 2012 and was further intensified in 2016, bringing down and disciplining tens of thousands of party members and government officers, including the incumbent and retired officers. Many of them have been arrested, brought to court for trial, and put in prison. This also has never happened in the history of the CPV. So Trọng had a strong influence in the CPV power structures, and his sudden death was a new opportunity for change in leadership. So the installment of the new leadership is the third major political development in Vietnam, following Trọng's death. After President Võ Văn Thưởng were disciplined and resigned, Tô Lâm, the then Minister of Public Security, was elected to presidency in June. And after Trọng passed away, Lâm was elected to the top party job, Secretary General. So Lum's position to the state president and CPP general secretary position within 2 months. Again, this never happened in the history of the CPV. So National Assembly state president, standing committees, and the secretariat and Politburo was also elected. So since August to the end of the year of 2024, the CPP continued what it called fulfilling the vacancy in leadership in the party and the government machinery, which include the chairperson of the National Assembly, as I said, the state president, the standing members of the secretariat, and the Politburo ministers. So as we have seen that the government and the party is also conducting restructurings and streamlining the structures. Now looking to the political developments in or the political life in Vietnam in 2025. So 2005, as Andrew said, there's a lot of activities and very busy years for Vietnam and the CPV. And what I call is super busy year for Vietnam. The CPV, for instance, has identified 2025 as of special importance in the political life of the country, which bears a lot of activities, as Andrew mentioned. 95 years of the founding of the CPV, 50 years of the end of the Vietnam War, 135th birthday anniversary of President Ho Chi Minh, 80 years of the founding of the People's Democratic Republic of Vietnam, which is now the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. And of course, the local party congresses and the preparation for the 14th CPV National Congress in early 2026. Now, in the foreign relations front, the 30 years of diplomatic relations with the US, celebration of the 75 years of diplomatic relations with a series of countries, China, Russia, Poland, Czech Republic, etc. And at the moment, the party is also conducting, as I said, the streamlining of the state and party apparatus. And this webinar happened exactly on the same day when in Hanoi, the party is holding its plenaries, and it has elected new members of the Politburo and also new member of the secretariat. So we can see that there's a lot of activities in 2025, and we can also see a lot of changes in 2025 and the years ahead. So I think all eyes now looking at the outcomes of the streamlining of the state and party apparatus, and also the preparations for the 14th Party Congress in early 2026. So I should stop here. It's 8 minutes for me, and I look forward to our conversation after that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Hai, for that background on how we got to the current political situation in terms of the top level leadership and what that means for the coming year. So to continue this, I'd like to invite Dr. Lena Le, who is the head of the International Relations Division in the University of Social Sciences and Humanities, Vietnam National University in Hanoi. And her research focuses on the Asia-Pacific region, ASEAN, and Vietnam's foreign policy. She's been a visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins SAIS, the University of South Australia, Australian National University, and the Stimson Center here in Washington. So welcome, Lena.
Thanks, Andrew, and good morning, everyone. I would like to thank USIP for hosting this event and providing me with the opportunity to share my insights into on Vietnam's evolving foreign policy. And also, I would like to say chúc mừng năm mới, everyone. Happy New Year's. So today, we'll be discussing about Vietnam foreign policies, its achievements over the recent years. What I mean by saying recent years, because I want to look into Vietnam foreign policy after the 30th National Congress in 2020. 2021 until now, and then some strategic outlook for the 2025. So Vietnam foreign policy is guided by the overarching vision outlined in the 13th National Congress of the Communist Party of Vietnam. And for those who might not remember, I would just recall it. It is characterized by independence, autonomy, multilateralizations, and diversification, proactive and active in international integrations in a comprehensive and intensive, extensive, and efficient manner. And the concept of bamboo diplomacy has become the defining metaphor, symbolizing flexibility, resilience, and rootedness of Vietnam foreign policy. So from my point of view, the achievements of Vietnam's foreign policy has been, you know, reflected into areas. One is political security diplomacy, and the other one is economic diplomacy. So when it goes to political and security diplomacies, in the past years, despite the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemics, the high-level diplomacy has remained dynamic. As of December 2024, Vietnam's leadership engaged in 260 diplomatic activities, and especially between September 2023 and June 2024, the country hosted a series of high-profile visits from world leaders. U.S. President Joe Biden's visit in September 2023 and elevated the U.S.-Vietnam relations to a comprehensive strategic partnership. Then Chinese President Xi Jinping's visited Vietnam in the late October and early November 2023. And then later on, we welcome Russian President Vladimir Putin's in June 2024. So these high-level engagements demonstrate Vietnam's abilities to navigate complex international relations and balancing its ties with major powers while advancing its national interests. Besides, Vietnam's diplomatic reach expanded significantly. By January 23rd, 2025, I mean today, Vietnam established partnership frameworks with 33 key partners. Up to now, Vietnam has 13 comprehensive partners, 11 strategic partners, and 9 comprehensive strategic partners, and it has diplomatic ties with 194 countries in the world. And beyond bilateral relations, Vietnam has actively participated in numerous multilateral forums and organizations. And, you know, and Vietnam's significant contribution to UN peacekeeping missions really, you know, highlight its commitments to international peace and security. And this multifaceted approach to international relations, you know, showcase Vietnam's growing influence on the global stage and its ability to engage quite effectively across various diplomatic platforms. When it goes to economics diplomacies, so under the proactive international integrations and diversification policy, Vietnam economics diplomacy has achieved, I have to say, substantial outcomes. Despite the global economic downturns post-COVID-19, Vietnam remains among few high-growth countries. And in 2024, Vietnam surpassed its social economic target, achieving 7% GDP growth, and the trade volume reached a record of $786 billion, with a foreign direct investment approach $40 billion, that places Vietnam among the top 15 FDI destinations globally. And it should be noted that in high technologies sectors and semiconductor sectors, big business show growing interest in the countries. Apple completed relocating 11 factories to Vietnam by 2024. And major tech firms like Intel, Google, Meta, etc. set to strategically expand in Vietnam. Especially end of December 2024, NVIDIA announced its plans of establishing an AI research and development centers and an AI data centers in the countries. So these achievements are, you know, largely, if not primarily, attributed to Vietnam's open door policy and international economic integration strategies. How about Vietnam international relations in 2025? As Dr. Hai mentions about the year's 2025, how significant it is to Vietnam with, you know, a series of anniversaries. So for me, Vietnam's foreign policy in 2025 will be characterized by, you know, a blend of continuities and adaptation. And the bamboo diplomacy remains a guidance for Vietnam's approach to international relations. Furthermore, Vietnam's economic trajectory plays, you know, a very crucial role in shaping its foreign policy or its behavior in international relations. So this economic strength provides a very solid foundation for Vietnam's diplomatic endeavors and allowing Vietnam to engage more confidently on the global stage. So the country's foreign policy in 2025 is expected to focus on several key areas. Firstly, Vietnam will, I think, continue to pursue its strategies of diversification and multilateralization of international relations. This approach aims to, you know, balance relationships with major powers, particularly in the context of intensifying competition between U.S., United States, and China. That is what we can, you know, foresee, especially under the Trump's administration. And by maintaining good relations with both nations, as well as other regional and global partners, Vietnam seeks to safeguard its interests and, you know, avoid over-reliance on any single countries. Secondly, the economics diplomacy win remains a cornerstone of Vietnam foreign policy. As the country strives to become an upper middle income nation by 2030s and high income nation by 2045, it will leverage its diplomatic ties to attract foreign investment, particularly in high tech sectors. And then lastly, Vietnam foreign policy in 2025 will also continue to emphasize its, you know, active participation in multilateral forums, particularly ASEAN. As a proactive member of the regional bloc, Vietnam seeks to contribute to peace and stability in the regions while enhancing its own international standing. So in 2025, I think Vietnam might face kind of challenge in, you know, still balancing the relation with major powers and also addressing kind of territorial dispute in the South China Sea. And also Vietnam also have to deal with, you know, managing domestic expectation from the government structures. However, I think in the domains of international relations, Vietnam's bamboo diplomacy approach, which characterized by flexibilities and resilience, will provide a framework for addressing this challenge while pursuing national interests. So I will stop here and looking forward to the Q&A and the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lena. Yeah, that's a fantastic overview of Vietnam's foreign policy approaches and what may be coming in the next year. So from sort of top level politics and foreign policy, we'll move now to social and state society relations in Vietnam now. And our next speaker is Dien Luong, who is a PhD student now at the University of Michigan and is also a visiting fellow at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute in Singapore. Dien's research explores how authoritarian regimes use new technologies to justify state control. He earned his master's in journalism from Columbia University as a Fulbright student. Dien, over to you. Welcome.
Thank you, Andrew, and a very warm good morning to you all from Ann Arbor, Michigan, on a freezing cold day. So let me share my slide. Okay, can you see my slide now? Okay, so from my two fellow panelists, Dr. Nguyen and Dr. Le, you have heard about how Vietnam's leadership navigates domestic politics and global partnerships. The focus of my talk is on how the new leadership needs to tap into the potential of one of the most important, if not important, constituencies, the young people. Last September, just in his first visit to the U.S. as the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam, Tô Lâm was speaking at Columbia University World Leader Forums. In response to a question about what Vietnam should do to engage overseas Vietnamese students, Lâm highlighted that overseas Vietnamese students don't necessarily need to return to Vietnam to contribute. They can do so from wherever they are. Yes, you may say this statement is largely political rhetoric, but still it does mark a departure from the traditional calls of other top leaders for overseas Vietnamese students to return. And it is even in sharper departure to Lâm's predecessor, Nguyễn Phú Trọng, who often voiced concern about, quote unquote, the political apathy or the political detachment of young people. In a broader sense, Lâm's statement somehow reflect his leadership style, which prioritized pragmatism over ideology. And this leadership style is with a younger generation who, according to a recent regional survey, also value political stability and economic progress. Just this week, the ICU Shop Isaac Institute released a survey about insights from youth in six countries in Southeast Asia, namely Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. Of the key findings, Vietnamese youth stand out as the most patriotic, the most trusting of their government, and the most economically optimistic in the region. These sentiments present a good chance for the Vietnamese leadership to rally them at the time the leadership need them the most. Here is why. Unwavering patriotism, according to the survey, Vietnamese youth lead the region in concern for national sovereignty, 91%. This finding is good news for a regime that has been always seeking to encourage patriotic nationalism among its young people in order to push its legitimacy. When it comes to trust in government, nearly 9 in 10 Vietnamese youth leaders express satisfaction with Vietnam's political system, the highest in the region, along with their Singaporean peers. And this finding is particularly reassuring for Tô Lâm, who took power after rare political upheavals, like Dr. Nguyễn has mentioned, in Vietnam. And indeed, in Vietnam, political stability has never been more important. But interestingly, 44% of Vietnamese youth agree with the statement that democracy is the best system of governance. Yeah, to be sure, 44% doesn't seem too bad, but in fact, it is the lowest in the region. But speaking from the perspective of the Vietnamese party state, this finding is also reassuring for a regime that has always been concerned about the prospect of youth-led movement that could overthrow autocratic regimes. I was referring to the popular uprisings in North Africa, the Arab Spring over a decade ago, or the Multi Alliance across Asia several years ago. But when it comes to the economic outlook, youth are the most optimistic in the region about their country's economic future, with 90% expressing confidence in their government development plans. Again, this pragmatic outlook aligns well with Tô Lâm's focus on economic growth, not ideology, as the foundation for the party's longevity and stability. But despite all these findings, Lâm still faces a complex challenge, the legacy of repressions under Nguyễn Phú Trọng, in which Lâm was considered a key enforcer as a former Minister of Public Security, the head of Vietnam security apparatus. And indeed, under Nguyễn Phú Trọng, sweeping crackdowns on mainstream media, cyberspace, or civil society created a climate of change that continues to stifle meaningful engagement. According to the IC survey, Vietnamese youth are the least likely to sign petitions or participate in online political organizing in the region. In another separate study I did, after a wave of arrests of high-profile environmentalists in 2021, digital activists in Vietnam have indeed avoided framing their message as a way that called for collective action in an apparent bid to avoid confronting the government. That might partly explain why there has not been any real fly street protests in Vietnam since 2018. But moving forward, and at the end of the day, the Vietnamese leadership seem to have a genuine opportunity to genuinely engage Vietnamese youth. But doing so would require and sustained effort that reforms on reopening civic space for dialogue, easing restrictions on digital activism, and creating platforms for youth participation in policy making. And indeed, given the context of Vietnam, empowering a patriotic or pragmatic youth to actively engage in civic life doesn't pose any threat to the regime. On the contrary, it would only bolster the regime's performative legitimacy and stability. Whether Tô Lâm or whoever in power embrace the opportunity or choose to keep the status quo is an open question. And I'm not trying to be not too pessimistic, but at the same time, I don't want to come across as overly optimistic. So I think it's best to conclude my talk with that open question. And I look forward to your question later on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I just remind everyone who's listening to please go to the USIP event page on the website to write questions, which we will discuss after our final speaker, who is Professor Mark Seidel. And he is Professor of Law and Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a board member at the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, among other positions. Professor Seidel has been active in Vietnam since 1991, including with the Ford Foundation. He's written widely on philanthropy and civil society in Vietnam, China, India, and the United States.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you especially to the other speakers who are far more knowledgeable about the situation in Vietnam than I am. And so I'm going to speak only very briefly, hopefully not taking the 8 minutes allotted, so that we can move to the questions that are already coming in. What I have to say, which really focuses on the civil society space, does not disagree in any way with the other three speakers. There is a moment now, as several of the speakers have said, in which a different route could be taken with respect to civil society, non-governmental activities in Vietnam. And as our last speaker said, and I agree with that, it's an open question as to whether the new current leadership will decide to take a different road in terms of its constraints and restrictions on civil society. We don't really know. But I have to say that so far, the outlook is probably not that hopeful. We have seen in recent years, and including in recent months, a continuation of significant restrictions and constraints on a variety of civil society activities, not just those that we might label as dissident activities, but also policy advice and consultancy groups that may wish to contribute to Vietnamese national development by weighing in on policy choices such as clean energy and other important pressing needs for Vietnam. Those restrictions and constraints on non-governmental organizations in Vietnam take a number of forms. And I'm not going to outline those in detail, but I'm just going to give a couple of bullet points, noting that the mechanisms, the levers that Vietnam chooses to constrain, restrict, mold its non-governmental sector are similar in terms of the mechanisms used to those used in many other countries around the regions. But the details sometimes differ. So a couple of those restrictions or levers or mechanisms in which the Vietnamese party and government can restrict, constrain, mold a civil society and non-governmental action in Vietnam. One is by security activity. We have seen a number of detentions, arrests, and convictions of non-governmental and civil society activists of various kinds over now a multi-year period. Not just those who might be defined in Vietnam or abroad as dissidents or anti-government activists, but going beyond that, as I said, to those who focus on energy, environment, and a variety of other policy-relevant issues in which, as far as we know, they have attempted to make contributions to policy dialogue in Vietnam. So that's the first lever, or the first mechanism, is activities by the security forces. Secondly, and this is something I work on in Vietnam, China, and other places, is regulatory activity, which constrains the nonprofit and non-governmental sector in a more systematic way. We have a number of examples of that in Vietnam, including some recent examples. We have long-term restrictions on the formation and activities of non-governmental organizations in Vietnam, adapted and somewhat strengthened recently by the new Decree 126 on the activities and regulation of non-governmental groups in Vietnam. We also have continuing restrictions on overseas non-governmental and philanthropic groups operating within Vietnam. That is both by regulatory activity, but also by activity in practice by regulators, which has tended to cause some frustration and confusion in the overseas non-governmental community about what is permitted in Vietnam and getting the permits for various kinds of activities. So restrictions on domestic groups, Decree 126 being the most recent iteration of that, are restrictions sometimes more in practice than in text on overseas non-governmental groups, and then a variety of other means that are used to constrain non-governmental or a civil society citizen action. There's a new report out, for example, from a Bangkok-based group, the 88 Project, which has worked on these issues in Vietnam. I do not always agree with that group's analysis, but they have pointed out that the restrictions on civil society, non-governmental activity in Vietnam go well beyond Decree 126 and formal restrictions on domestic non-governmental activities. They include the cybersecurity law, the law on the press, the law on information technology, the law on telecommunications, and a variety of other statutory and regulatory mechanisms that may constrain citizen action. So those are three levers, three mechanisms, restrictions on domestic organizations, restrictions in practice or in text on foreign organizations working in Vietnam that make things more difficult, and a variety of other mechanisms. Let me point out that there's an analogy between these mechanisms, restrictions, constraints in Vietnam, and what is occurring in China and in other places around the Asia-Pacific region, where we see these four fundamental tools, actions by the security forces, regulatory constraints on domestic organizations, regulatory and practice constraints on overseas organizations, and a broad umbrella or panoply of other mechanisms that can be used, data protection, cybersecurity, and lots of others, to restrain civil society activity. That's playing out in real time. We see people continuing to be taken and some released. Sometimes those releases are negotiated with the United States, for example. We have seen that recently. Vietnam, like China, has a policy of keeping a reservoir of people in detention who can be negotiated for at various times. And as some are taken, others are released. That's a similar dynamic that we see in a number of other countries. And I think there's no reason to think that these kinds of levers and mechanisms are going to stop. But as with the previous speaker, I'm going to leave that as an open question, with the hope that as the political situation stabilizes in Vietnam after a period of a considerable tumult, as we have seen from the previous speakers, one can hope that the current new Vietnamese leadership sees a more positive role for non-governmental and civil action in Vietnam, and we'll have to wait and see if that develops. I can't personally be that optimistic about that myself, but I will leave it, as Yen did, as an open question. And with that, Andrew, I'm going to stop and leave it for questions. Thank you all very much. Andrew, thank you for organizing this and the wonderful staff at USIP.
Great. Thanks to all of our panelists for your insightful and diverse views. And we've gotten a number of excellent questions coming in that are tough to choose among. But I want to start with where Vietnam positions itself in the U.S.-China competition and how that could play out as we enter a second Trump administration. Is Vietnam totally neutral? Or is there a chance that Vietnam might lean towards one or another major power in some aspects? Lena discussed this a little in her remarks, so maybe I'll start with Hai, and then other panelists feel free to jump in.
All right. Thank you very much, Andrew. Well, I think it's very interesting questions, and this kind of questions, I think, is a recurrence and repeated all the times. Let me just quote what interesting in a way that 2 days ago the same question was asked to Prime Minister Phạm Minh Chính in Davos, Switzerland. The financial reporters asked him, what is the positions of Vietnam between China and the United States?
This is kind of media interesting focus, isn't
one. It? Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not in the positions of the governments of Vietnam, but this is what Phạm Minh Chính said. Well, Vietnam's foreign policy is to be a independence, autonomous, multilateralization, diversification, be a good partner, reliable partners, etc. Right? So this is the foreign policy, and Prime Minister Phạm Minh Chính said. Now, and also on the 18th of January, there was a telephone call between Secretary General Tô Lâm and Xi Jinping in exchange of the congratulations of the 75 years of diplomatic relations between the two countries. And Secretary Tô Lâm said, with China, Vietnam plays or give priority. And on the other occasions, Vietnamese leaders said in relationship between Vietnam and the U.S., Vietnam considers the relationship between Vietnam and the U.S. as a strategic choice. So you can see for Vietnam, both China's and the United States is a very important partners. They don't want to take side with China's or with the United States. This is important. I think that also a lesson in the past for Vietnam. But of course, I think the best answer for this one is that also in the conversation between Prime Minister Phạm Minh Chính and the reporter from the Financial Times, when she asked him if he was invited to play golf in Mar-a-Lago with President Trump, would he play? So he said, well, whatever for the best of the country, for the nation, I will play. So this is a very pragmatic answer and response. So I would say in this, for these questions and for the future's, relationship between Vietnam and China and where Vietnam stand between in the context of the competition between China and Vietnam is that whatever the best for Vietnam, then Vietnam will do. You know, that is the pragmatic way. And you often hear that Vietnamese leaders always emphasize national interest should be put on the top of Vietnam diplomacy. So that is my response to that.
Great, thanks. Well, and we'll come back to you later with an analysis on the golf game of various top leaders. But does anyone else want to respond to this question about U.S.-China competition and Vietnam's position?
Just very briefly, Andrew, I often think about this comparing Vietnam and China. And I wonder whether Vietnam's America specialists have as much tie-in to leadership, as much opportunity to advise leadership, as some of the senior Americanists in Beijing and Shanghai clearly do. That is not to say they're policymakers. They're not policymakers. But China has shown over a number of years now that it is willing to listen to Chinese specialists on the United States and other important areas who are coming to the United States, going back to China, and bringing back useful information. I don't know whether the political leadership in Hanoi, again, this is an open question, is as willing to take in information from non-party, non-governmental, non-foreign ministry, et cetera, sources. And I would say that worries me a little bit because I think China has gotten very good at figuring out how to bring in policy inputs, or I should say informational inputs from academics and others who have contact with the United States. So I'll leave that as an open question and also leave it as an open question as to whether in Vietnam that's a similar unfortunate situation with respect to China as well and China specialists and specialization in Vietnam too. Thank you.
Great, thanks for that. Let's look at a specific case. We've gotten several questions relating to the East Sea or South China Sea. Do you see a risk of confrontation in 2025 in the sea? There has been, obviously, between the Philippines and China in the last year. While Vietnam has been more quiet, how will Vietnam respond to Chinese challenges? Can I ask Lena first on this one?
Thanks, Andrew, for the question. It's very interesting question, I have to say. So, that's like China and Philippines have moved toward more, direct confrontation over competing claims in the South China Sea. Many people, say that Vietnam has stayed quite relatively quiet. But I think Vietnam will likely continue to maintain, highest possible degrees of neutrality. It will insulate itself from any, unnecessary kind of conflicts or not the direct ones that might, influence to Vietnam's. And I believe this remained plausible, especially since China and the Philippines may not necessarily escalate the tension in 2025. I think so because, China need to carefully consider how to respond to the U.S. new policy under President Trump administrations, And also there are some kind of other reason lead me to that belief that there will be, there might be some clash, but not that, huge violence or, anything kind of prone to the war. Because China's strategic interest thus far lies in, avoiding wars in South China Sea. Approximately 40% of China import and export trade flows through the maritime routes in the regions. So the consequence of conflicts in South China Sea would be very unpredictable and far-reaching. And therefore, China's most, effective strategy is, salami slicings and also using gray zone tactics. And besides, if China want to use military force, I mean, in a kind of larger, using a lot like war, the situation, I think it would have done it before because the situation has been less favorable since the onset of the Russia-Ukraine conflict now. China's, I don't think, will likely to risk to be, international isolated or receive condemnations and sanctions similar to what Russia fakes. So that is what my, ideas. I don't know. I'm just like hope listening to others.
Would anyone like to add on that?
I just want to add briefly that, I think in this case, from the Vietnamese point of view, I think Vietnam has taken a very smart tactics, in the sense that, of course, Vietnam is not quite, you know, quiet, in the sense that it also raised concerns in one or another occasions. For instance, in regional forums, Vietnam also very concerned about the complicated situation in the South China Sea. And also in, if you, you know, pay attention to the meetings of Vietnamese leaders in own their foreign relations activities, they weren't very concerned about it. And their own way, that's one way in order to draw attention from the international community to the situation in South China Sea. So I think this is a smart way of conducted by Vietnam, like in the case of Russian invasion of Ukraine. Many people say Vietnam, you know, doesn't, you know, protest Russia. But from my point of view, Vietnam's position is very clear. Vietnam is not happy with Russian invasion of Ukraine in many sense, because it only emphasized the international law, not use of force, etc., and sovereignty. And more importantly, Vietnam's leaders have met Ukraine presidents in many times. So it clearly shows, you know, the Vietnam approach in a smart way in diplomacy, and also that is the approach that Vietnam on the way take in order to address in a very complicated, a very dangerous world today.
So as a follow-up to this, how important do you all think ASEAN as a regional mechanism and other mechanisms like BRICS, right, which Indonesia is joining and Thailand and Malaysia are becoming partners, you know, as well as other global and regional mechanisms. Is that a priority for Vietnamese foreign policy? Can I point at Dien first and then others?
Sorry, this question is not quite in my wheelhouse, but okay. Can I answer the question about the U.S.-China rivalry, or do we have time for that, or just leave it for the ASEAN question? Because I want to build something on
I'll come back to you. So okay. Maybe, Lena, yeah. If you want to respond to the ASEAN and BRICS question then.
Yeah, so I found the question about ASEAN is interesting because, you know, Vietnam is trying to diversify its relations and oppose, you know, multilateral kind of organizations. Vietnam is likely to leverage ASEAN mechanisms strategically to defend its interests and, you know, objective while navigating the complex dynamics of U.S.-China competition. Here's, ASEAN is actually another way that helped Vietnam. So some key ways that Vietnam leaders may utilize ASEAN is, firstly, promoting ASEAN centrality. Vietnam will likely continue to emphasize ASEAN's central role in regional affairs to maintain, you know, strategic autonomy. Then also about Vietnam may use ASEAN economic mechanism to boost growth and, you know, reduce dependence on any single power, even though it's really hard because, you know, China and U.S. still, there's two top kind of trading partners of Vietnam. And ASEAN also provides Vietnam frameworks to engage major powers while maintaining strategic flexibilities, using ASEAN central multilateral forums to engage both U.S. and China at the same time. And, you know, Vietnam may also use Chile ASEAN in several ways to insulate itself from U.S.-China rivalry, like, as I mentioned, emphasize ASEAN unity and centrality to resist bilateral pressure from major power. So that is how Vietnam is now. I think there's a lot of benefit for Vietnam in when it goes to ASEAN. And since I mentioned somewhere, ASEAN since 1995 is still one of the mechanisms that Vietnam have been very proactive because it's bring a lot of, you know, kind of benefit for the countries. Yes, so that's my viewpoint. What else should I say? Or I think other people might have another.
Yeah, let's go back to Dien then and ask what you wanted to share about U.S. and China. And also another question we got, which relates to your presentation, is how do you explain the low support for democracy in Vietnam with young people, and has that changed from previous years?
Okay, so the first question, I just want to follow up on what Alden had said about the U.S.-China rivalry. When it comes to covering the U.S.-China rivalry, the Western media has somehow fallen into a somehow simplistic framing, like and pro-China, pro-U.S., or either way. But if you look at how Vietnam treated bilateral ties with China, it needs to be looked at in a more complex and nuanced way. The Communist Party views China as an ideological ally. The government views China somehow as an unreliable partner. And yes, the public views China as a constant threat to their sovereignty, like the case in the South China Sea. The same applies to the U.S., and I want to refer back to the speech by Prime Minister Chính at Davos. Despite on the Chinese statement on U.S.-Vietnam ties, he did make a point about the legacy of the Vietnam War. And he did highlight that the U.S. still had to be responsible for the war damages during the Vietnam War. So when it comes between Vietnam, U.S. and China, there are certain positions that Vietnam is still very firm, and it depends on where you look at. That's my point. The second question about democracy, and I want to push back a bit on the premise of the question, because from what I understand, the premise of the question seemed to be that there has been some sense or some desire for democracy among Vietnamese youth in the first place. But the thing is, surveys about political attitudes among Vietnamese youth are extremely rare. So we don't know exactly if Vietnamese youth had in the first place the aspiration for democracy. This is not to dismiss your idea. I'm just raising the question as somehow to provide some food for thought, but some reference. In 27, the first year after Trump took office, a Pew survey showed that the highest support for Putin and Trump was found among Vietnamese public. Just some reference. But again, my point is we don't have enough data to say that whether the sense of democracy has been in decline or rising among Vietnamese youth in the first place.
Thank you. And final question or questions for Mark first, relating to civil society. So a couple questions. Do you think that restrictions on civil society are affecting Vietnam's economic development potential in 2025 and beyond? And second, is there any sign that a lot of the restrictions and delays on approvals for workshops and conferences and other international activities will change? Thanks.
After 5 years on Zoom, I should know to unmute myself. So very briefly, in general terms, I do think that restrictions on civil society, not just in Vietnam, but in many other countries, do hamper and delay economic development potential. I think more voices in the process is better in the long run for balanced, sustainable, rapid economic growth and economic development. I think that's true in Vietnam, and I think it's true in other countries. The delays in approvals for various kinds of activities, whether it's formation of groups, domestic or foreign, conferences or other activities. Again, I like Dien's formulation. I'd like to leave that as an open question. But as I said, I cannot be cheerily optimistic that we are going to see reductions in those delays, given the long-term, not recent, long-term view of non-governmental activity in Vietnam as being something that is potentially dangerous and needs to be monitored and molded and controlled pretty strictly. So I can't be optimistic that we will see some of those delays and regulatory roadblocks coming down, but I'd like to be hopeful. Back to you, Andrew. Thank you.
I think that's a great note to end our discussion. Again, thank our panelists and everyone who has contributed great questions for discussion. Hope we can continue these discussions on and offline in the coming months. I'd like to call everyone's attention to several other upcoming USIP activities relating to Vietnam. The first is we have an essay contest that's open from now through February 15th. In English or Vietnamese, on the subject of memories of war and peace. And there are different age categories for students and the general public in both countries. Information is on our website. And then in mid-April, we are expecting to open a temporary exhibit at USIP headquarters called Vietnam 5030 about the dual upcoming anniversaries, with exhibit materials from USIP and several non-governmental partner organizations. Please follow our website and keep an eye out for information about the opening and other events relating to the exhibit. It will run until mid-July. And at that time, we're also expecting to open a new permanent exhibit on U.S.-Vietnam cooperation on war legacies at the War Remnants Museum in Ho Chi Minh City. Once again, thanks everyone for your interest in today's event. I wish you and all of our colleagues in Vietnam a very happy year of the wood snake, Tet Ut Thi, starting next week. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chúc mừng năm mới.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.